Haitians living under temporary protected status get an extension. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. The Trump administration set a deadline for ending TPS for July of this year, but a court decision has pushed that off until January of 2020. What will that extra time mean for thousands of Haitians living in South Florida? Also, a youth climate summit this week will give young people an opportunity to learn more about the impacts of climate change. One of the speakers is featured in the Netflix documentary, Chasing Coral. And have you read Witness Poetry? A Palm Beach State College professor recently won a prestigious poetry award, and he wants you to get interested in a different type of poetry. Finally, do you love to dance the mambo? We're going to learn about a new film that focuses on mambo-nicks, Jews from the 50s and 60s in love with the art form.
Even Tito Puente said if it weren't for the Jewish people, it never would have taken off.
All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us. More than 30,000 Haitians with temporary protected status living in Florida will have 9 more months before that status ends. A Trump administration ruling to have the TPS program for thousands of Haitians, Salvadorans, Nicaraguans, and Sudanese, end by July of 2019, now extended to January of 2020. Some of the largest pockets of the Haitian diaspora nationwide live here in South Florida. Joining us now is Marlene Bastian, executive director of the nonprofit organization FEM, Family Action Movement Network, or Haitian Women of Miami. And she is back in studio with us. Ms. Bastian, always a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. Good to see you again.
Good to see you. Happy New Year. We haven't talked in a while.
Happy New Year. We have not talked in a while, but it's so good to be here.
It has been a very busy couple of weeks. Mm-hmm. Since the Trump administration originally announced the end of Haitian TPS, I mean, you've been fighting to get it reinstated, but also fighting to help a lot of these families, mm-hmm. again, thousands of people that are impacted by this. In what ways do you view this recent court ruling as a success? It extends the deadline, but really only until January of next year.
Indeed. It is really actions that were published by the Department of Homeland Security to comply to the judge's injunction in the case of Ramos versus Nielsen, which was filed October 3rd, 2019. So the judge stipulated in that case that if a decision has not been rendered since the case the Trump administration appealed, right? Then they have to publish new rules pertaining to the extension. So this is really an action by the Trump administration to abide by the judge's injunction and to do what it was ordered to do, which is to not remove these TPS recipients while the case is still pending.
So what is your greatest concern? I mean, July is around the corner now. This isn't January of next year, but, I mean, as you've seen, time flies by.
Mm-hmm.
So what is the biggest concern, though, right now?
The biggest concern is that these families have a temporary reprieve, that January 2nd, 2020 is fast coming. And families, they were happy with the news, but they're still concerned about not having a permanent solution.
And by the way, yeah. I mean, people understand that this is, again, temporary, that this is just till January, that this isn't, oh, it's fixed now, everything's fine.
Well, we want to make sure that they understand
okay.
that. At our press event the other day, the 28th, we did indicate that. And then some of the TPS recipients who spoke at this press event did allude to the fact that it is still temporary, that it is about time for Congress to act. And that's why we at FEM, we are pushing for Congress will introduce a bill March 12, combining TPS and DACA, because both groups have a lot in common.
So the idea behind TPS, again, is to help people who are trying to escape a horrible situation in their country, give them protected status for a little while, mm-hmm. that eventually they could go home. And it's this idea that, well, everything's fine in Haiti, they can go back home. Remind people of what's happening in Haiti.
Well, Haiti is going through a lot of upheaval right now, a lot of political problems. People are on the streets almost daily. Thousands and thousands have taken to the street asking for President Jovenel. They're trying to get President Jovenel Moïse out of office. A lot of young people who are gravely dissatisfied by the lack of progress. And in Haiti, wherever you turn, people are really going through a tough time, no access to education and all. So the situation is in chaos right now. Haiti is in chaos, so we know that there is no way that the Haitians can be returned there. Even the State Department's advisory, prevents, try to, warn U.S. citizens from going there. So, and then when we look at Salvador, Nicaragua, right, and Sudan, these are nations that are also in turmoil. So,
you probably know this. I mean, this goes back to January. There was an internal government emails that showed that the administration wanted very badly to end TPS for Haitians, and it ignored its own government's research that showed serious health and safety concerns for people living in Haiti. I mean, does that surprise you?
Not at all. And I don't know if you're aware that there are civil lawsuits in addition to this lawsuit. I recently came from Brooklyn, New York, to testify in another lawsuit, the Saget versus the Trump administration. And then it's the same arguments were raised that the government officials were testified that while they were working for the Obama administration, they did provide documentation that the situation in Haiti is still very, very serious, very is still grave, that people, the conditions are still bad, that people could not return. And then these data were completely ignored. In the hearing, even handwritten notes were provided to show people discussing the concerns, and then the Trump administration's officials just ignored it and then terminated TPS anyway. And then this is basically, Louis, the basis of all these four lawsuits that the Trump administration did not use country conditions, did not respect the law by, using country conditions to make this decision, and instead used basically animus per his own actions and words, and then racism to make this decision to terminate TPS.
I'm talking with Marlene Bastian, executive director of the nonprofit organization FAM. We are discussing the recent ruling for individuals with temporary protected status, now extended, the deadline extended to January of 2020. Previously, it was July of this year, which is just a few months away.
Mm-hmm.
In talking with Haitians as they were getting ready for the deadline, they get this extension, but I want to know what you're hearing from people about what to do next. What comes next? You can't go home. You can't go back to Haiti. Is it going somewhere else? Is it just hiding, staying under, going underground and not being seen? What are people planning?
What they are hoping right now, and then we have a couple of TPS in Washington, D.C. today. So some of our members travel today to Washington to make this case, this very case, that Congress acts. It is time for Congress to act, to find a permanent solutions, because these are members of our community who are deeply rooted in our community. I mean, they are our teachers, our doctors, our PhD students, our organizers, our hotel and restaurant workers. These are people who are part of our communities, and they are deeply rooted, and they contribute financially to our economy while uproot them and send them to nation in turmoil, nation that cannot receive them. So the point that we are I'm trying to say is that the TPS recipients are keenly aware that this is a temporary solution, but they hope in their heart that Congress will finally act.
But have you met anybody who's, whether they're thinking they have to sell their home, their business?
Well, they are asking. They are still asking. They come to our center. We have meetings every other Thursday to discuss these issues. Right? Some are still. They are still. Assessing, continuously assessing their situation, because it's still in the back of their heads. I mean, it constitutes a great deal of anxiety for them. They are constantly thinking about it. Some of them have been advised to assess their cases to see if there are other ways that they can adjust their status. So we are doing all this work with them, and they are keenly aware that this is an unstable situation, and we hope, and then they hope, I think, that this situation will be stabilized.
But what do they think if we reach the deadline and it happens, and so now it's like January arrives? I mean, what are they telling you? I want to know what they're telling you about. Okay, I'm just going to stay, or okay, I'll leave. I got to go find another place to live.
Well, I think they will consider every option to protect their families, to keep their families together. What I can tell you for sure is that I've yet to meet a family member who would leave their children behind. Whatever the decision that they make, they will have to take their children with them. And then there is an estimated 275,000 to half a million children involved here. So this is something to consider. If a permanent solution is not found, we could witness the biggest mass deportation of U.S.-born children to nations in turmoil. So when they talk to me, they don't talk to me about, you know, going somewhere, but they talk to me, to us, about their hopes, their yearnings and their hopes for the future.
Because many of them have children who were born here.
Yes.
So it creates a different, a very interesting situation.
Yes, indeed.
The other thing, too, is thinking about what legal recourse any of these folks have. As you said, you're talking to them about all the different possibilities. But I remember talking to you the last time that everybody's got a different situation, a different story.
Every case is different.
Yeah.
That is why it is so important. And then you really hit it in the nail the last time, for people to go to someone who's qualified, like an immigration lawyer. You know, don't listen to people on the street asking you to bring money. In this case, for example, you don't need to do anything. If you've already re-registered for TPS, you don't need to do anything. Your work permit will be automatically renewed. But everybody has a story is different, which is why we ask you to go to Catholic Charities, come to FAM, go to AIJ, go to people who know what they are doing. Don't listen to the notaries and people who are asking you for money, because in this specific case, there is no money to spend. Your work permit will be automatically renewed.
And
I want people to know that.
And there are people out there trying to scam.
Oh, we're already getting calls at our center. Is it true that we have to renew work permit? Is it true that we have to file again? No. If you've already renewed, you don't have to do anything. If you've already re-registered, you don't need to do anything. Your work, if you did not register, you can register now.
Let me finish with this. I want to ask you about, what lawmakers have you spoken to? Because, again, you're pressing Congress to do something. But what have you heard from, you know, our congressional leaders from the area?
Well, they are in support. We know former Congressman Cubero did introduce a bill. There are about five bills introduced now, and there is one that will be introduced March 12th. The congressional delegation of South Florida is very much in support of finding a permanent solution for TPS and DACA. And
a very vocal one, Congresswoman Donna Shalala.
And then we met with them while they were candidates, and we're meeting with them again. And then we are lucky that they are really in sync with us in terms of finding a permanent solution. And then last year we had 42 meetings with members of Congress on both sides of the aisles. A lot of them didn't know about TPS. That's why we always try to bring our TPS members, right, to Washington, D.C., so that they can see these people. These are family members with children, with U.S.-born children. These are employers, employees, homeowners, business owners. These are people who contribute. Why will you remove them from this certainty, from this life, right, to send them to an unstable and a violent situation? So the lawmakers, we were a little bit surprised that many of them were not aware that DCPS recipients, some of them have been here for a long time, you know, let's take Salvador, for example. Some of them have been here for 30 years, 40 years. You're going to remove these people and send them to Salvador, where gangs are running, you know, amok and threatening, you know, little girls and little boys. This is a very difficult situation. And then Congress needs to ask to act. And then we are happy that the congressional delegation of South Florida is in support, and then we have members in Washington right now to make their case for a permanent solution, Louis, a permanent solution for families to stay.
I know you have, you're hopeful, you're a hopeful person, and you bring that with you every time you talk, and I appreciate that.
Thank you so much.
Again, Marlene Bestjan, Executive Director of the nonprofit organization FAM, or again, talking about this issue of Haitian TPS. because the extension, court decision that came down recently, extended it to January of 2020 because it was set for July. So we're going to follow up on the story. We'll keep following it and see what's going on and keep you informed. Always a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Pleasure to see you. Thank you so much.
All right. Still to come, how can we get young people on board with saving the world's coral? We'll tell you all about that coming up next here on Sundial. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. We are the first generation that can end poverty. We are also the last generation that can show, that can slow global warming before it's too late. That's a quote from United Nations Secretary General Ban Ki-moon. Moon was in Miami just a few weeks ago examining the first phases of the city's resiliency projects and ongoing responses to the threats posed by global warming. Now, as the city continues its focus on climate change projects and infrastructure, one local school is ensuring that young people will be an important part of that development. Gulliver Schools, in partnership with FIU, the Chloe Institute, and National Geographic, is hosting the Miami's first Youth Climate Summit this weekend. Zach Rago is among the keynote speakers. He's featured in the Netflix documentary, Chasing Coral. He joins us in studio. Zach, great to have you.
Hey, thank you guys for having me.
Thank you for being here. Also joining us in studio, Gulliver Schools biology teacher, Emilia Odife, did I say that right?
Yes.
Odife, thank you. Sorry about that. She was part of the National Geographic Explorers program, which took her to the Galapagos for 10 days back in 2017. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
You know what? Let me start with that real quickly.
Okay.
I want to ask you about, you know, your work with National Geographic. It took you to this part of the world most of us don't get to see. And, you know, being a teacher, I mean, you're stuck in the classroom. So I wonder, you know, how often do you get out and get to see the environment that you have such a passion for?
Well, I'm lucky because what happened is with the National Geographic Ruffner Teacher Fellows, they actually have expeditions all over the world. I chose Galapagos because I'm environmental and like it. But students, I mean, other fellows went to Antarctica and Iceland. So they have been all over the place. And I'm lucky because at Gulliver, I started the field studies program a couple of years ago with another teacher as an academic club. So we started like going out and doing coral restoration, and now it is a class. So I get to go outside whenever I feel like.
That is awesome. So you go to the Galapagos, and I mean, you think about it, this is where Charles Darwin's, you know, whole origin of species pops up. I'm wondering, as you're walking around, are you thinking about what he was seeing and what he was thinking?
It is kind of like stepping back in time, and many a times you just stop and you're like, oh my gosh, I am really in the Galapagos. But at the same time, there were areas that I was looking at them like, this reminds me of the Everglades. And I know it sounds weird and silly for some people, but I learned very much there that people were so invested in their conservation of their the archipelago that I was thinking, we can do that in Florida. That's not a problem. We just need to get the people involved. But yeah, Darwin was ever present in my mind, seeing the giant tortoises, the blue-footed boobies, and it was all over. And I get to scuba dive, which was not planned, but it was hosted by Lindblad Expeditions, and the CEO of Lindblad, Sven, he was there celebrating the 60th anniversary of Lindblad Expeditions in Galapagos, and he knew that there were two teachers that were National Geographic certified, and they were there, and he approached me, and he said, you must be the diver. Like, yeah.
Now you're diving.
So now I'm diving.
What, is that the? I want to know, like, give me one memorable moment, because I want to know, like, how, you go on these experiences, you have these experiences, and you want to bring that back to the classroom. So what's a moment that you had that you brought back to the students?
Well, there were actually two very present moments. One of them was underwater. We were diving, and there was a lot of plankton, so the visibility wasn't that great, but you could feel that you were not alone. And in that moment, I just stopped. I went vertical, just trying to look around, and there were, like, hammerheads swimming past me. And I was just, like, in awe, and the other individual who I was diving with was screaming. I could just hear them underwater, and I'm like, be quiet. We're not here. So, and the second moment, we were in Fernandina. And honestly, you just see all the lava and you're like, this is the beginning. And I was thinking, this is what I want to take in the classroom. We have a time to start again. And I think we have to reset the button. So that's kind of what it was.
talking about deep sea going underwater and seeing life, you know, from a very different perspective, you know, coming back to Zach Rago. People who've seen the documentary, Chasing Coral, beautiful but also depressing, because we get to see firsthand. And I know that was the purpose. It was to show us. We hear it all the time, but look, here it is. This is what's happening. But real quickly, I wanted to ask you, Zach, about, as I asked Amelia, about how you're trying to bring this to students, because that's part of your mission here, is to get them involved as well. What's the mission for you? What's the message for you, for them?
Yeah, totally. I mean, on my end, I grew up that nerdy kid that was obsessed with the natural world and going out catching snakes, what have you. And I think every kid is born a scientist. And I think that the way that our current education system is set up, we kind of tear away at their curiosity over the years. And it's really unfortunate, because science is, yes, about numbers and data, and scientists can be portrayed in a very particular way, but there's also this experiential portion that Emily already touched on, and this almost bond with those around you, and being out in the field with people that love the same thing you do, are fascinated by something that you share in common with each other. And that is what we need to be promoting to students, and say, you know, these places are beautiful, and we all have this connectivity to the natural world in one way or another. And if you follow that, that's the best thing you can do to solve some of these environmental issues that we have, is cultivate and you know, hold on to any passion that we can give these kids. And they also don't realize that their voices are unbelievably powerful. You know, kids are the best constituents that we have in this country. And unfortunately, they don't necessarily have the influence to let them know that they have that type of power, and they can stand up and make a big splash. So
is it true? I mean, so you were that kid. I didn't collect snakes, but I did appreciate nature. That you still have a collection of coral, right?
Yes, sir.
At home. Tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah, I still, to this day, have a 150-gallon display tank, around 60 or so species of coral in there. And yeah, you know, they're kind of like my little babies.
Where did that passion come from?
You know, I was very lucky. My father is an educator as well as my mom. But he runs a program taking about 30 students to the Big Island of Hawaii every summer. So little 6-year-old Zach kind of got to shadow high school kids that were doing marine biology and snorkeling. And, you know, as a kid that grew up in the Rocky Mountains out in Colorado, having this kind of new realm of the natural world open up with the ocean, which, you know, you guys in Miami know it all too well. You got it in your backyard. You're very lucky. But for me, it was just so novel and vast, and I just kind of fell in love with it, and ultimately kind of found my niche with the corals. But
and we talk about corals, and again, coming back to the film and talking about the danger corals are facing. You know about all the dangers of corals here in Florida and along down the coast are facing right now.
Absolutely. You know, the Keys and you know, southern Florida as a whole has, you know, an incredible ecosystem and an incredible, you know, marine ecology that's going on here. But they have been, you know, damaged over the past few decades. Fortunately, you guys are also lucky in the fact that you have some really incredible people doing, you know, really fascinating work on these corals. You know, whether it's the Coral Reef Restoration Foundation, which I know Emily works with quite a lot, or Moat Marine Lab down in Summerlin Key, or even, you know, folks like Coral Morphologic and Colin Ford, who's here in Miami. There's so much activity here in southern Florida that makes it really exciting to be doing all that we can to protect this these species that are pretty unusual as well. And, you know, it's a pretty special place here.
Many of those people we have talked to as well. Talking with Zach Rago and Amelia Odife. She's a biology teacher with Gulliver Schools and also part of the National Geographic Explorers Program. Zach, you'll know, he's an environmentalist and a coral geek, as he told us, but you know, if you watch the documentary Chasing Corals, that's where you're going to know him from. And again, they're holding the Youth Climate Summit at FIU. It's happening this weekend. We have information on our social media, WLRN Sundial, so check it out. Amelia, tell us about the summit and the students, what they're going to experience. What is it you want them to experience?
Okay, so the summit, it was designed pretty much for both educators and students. There's going to be separate sessions for educators in which they're going to learn about the National Geographic framework, learning framework. But for the students, every time they hear the word climate change, they think about temperatures. So we wanted to give them a vast information about climate change and its effects on everything, the land, the sky, the ocean. And the students there, they're going to hear from amazing people, from Zach. We're going to have Ron McGill, Andres Russo, Tori Linder, Anne Haywood, Kerry Mahonan, Tiffany Melvin. So we have all these environmentalists that are willing to come and talk to our students about what is their projects that they're doing. The final objective is to create a student advisory board on climate change. We want to bring in the different students from the different schools, not just Gulliver, but everybody, to the table so we can amplify the different voices that are. So if there's a project in any of our public schools that they're doing a great work, how can we support them? So that's what I'm doing.
The summit to me seems like the place where you can start getting students more involved in the issue. But something Zach just said, I want your take on
this.
Are we teaching science the right way? Are we teaching climate science the right way in our schools?
No.
Okay.
Yet.
this is the place to be honest.
Not yet. We're changing that. Florida is known for a lot of test takings, and I am blessed to work in a place in which that's not such an influence. And I can expand my curriculum, and other teachers are limited. And when it comes to climate change, Zach and I were talking today, it's not so much learning the science behind, but being able to communicate the effects, being able to communicate the needs that our students and our community have in order to prepare ourselves and mitigate the factors that are affecting that are climate change. So
I want to hear from you. I mean, at what point are we taking that away? As you were saying, taking it away from the students, what could we be doing better?
You know, I think it really comes down to experience. Get them out of the classroom a little bit. What they're doing at Gulliver is incredible. That's how I actually originally had met Emily in Bonaire, where they were working at a site that I worked on. And it's those types of things, which I was also lucky enough to experience as a kid, that, you know, changes something in your head and maybe you get a little culture shock out of it, or a little bit of novelty that's outside of the classroom. It's not a textbook. It's hands-on. You're getting dirty. And it's that experience that allows kids to create not only a passion, but I think develop a better understanding. And it's also that experience that something that we talked about on the way here that's the most important thing is, you know, creating a story. That goes back, kind of circles all the way back into Chasing Coral. It's a human story at the end of the day. I like to think that most people that are watching are, you know, either relating to myself or relating to Richard or some of the other scientists. But at the same time, while they're cheering us on, while we're on this adventure, they're absorbing information about something that they're not necessarily being force-fed. It's not talking heads. It's presented in an interesting way that isn't forced teaching. It's
right.
Not more school. It's not any of these things that turn kids off. It's getting them excited at the aspect of adventure and exploration and the wonders of our world.
And I think
that
yeah.
type of communication that's brilliant.
I think about this, what documentary films can do and the impact that they can have. You think about, one documentary on, killer whales in SeaWorld changed everything. This documentary, what have you heard from people about maybe what it's changed, how people view what they don't see? Because none of us really ever see the coral.
Totally. I mean, it is a world that is completely out of sight and out of mind. And in Florida, this might be the case. But in the global scheme of things, you know, less than 1% of people have an opportunity to spend time underwater. And you have this wealth of life and diversity that exists there. And to give them a little bit of a platform, I think, was the biggest thing through the film. It's been received really well. I think that it's designed in a way where we didn't play the politics game either. You know, it really is an adventure story about divers and scuba divers going out and trying to capture something. And that's kind of it. Hard stop. The reasons are the reasons, but it's the story that's important. But it's been overall, it's been received quite well, and I think it's given coral reefs a platform in the media as a whole, which is really exciting to see.
Amelia, as we finish up here real quickly, is come back and tell me real fast about how you're getting other schools involved. What are you doing to get more schools in this?
Okay, so pretty much like my students and I, when we decided back in November that we were going to do this after participating in a youth climate summit in California, we participated via Skype, the students decided we want our own. And we started sit down planning, okay, so how are we going to pull this together? So they came up with a list of schools that we know they have a strong environmental component. They were responsible for finding email addresses and everything. And then we just started pretty much bombarding them with emails and, you know, social media. So we're hoping anybody who's listening to, we still have places available. Come and join us, log in, visit us. It's going to be a very interesting day.
And it is Miami's first Youth Climate Summit happening this weekend. We heard from Zach Rago. He's one of the keynote speakers. He's featured in the Netflix documentary Chasing Coral. Gulliver School's biology teacher, Amelia Odife, she's part of the National Geographic Explorers Program, which took her to the Galapagos. And she's, you know, helping to really expand, as she said, expand this out beyond one school to get a lot of schools and a lot of students involved. We have more information on our social media, WLRN Sundial. Amelia, Zach, thank you so much. I really appreciate it. All right, still to come, we're going to meet a local poet who recently won a prestigious award, and he's going to do a little reading for us. That's coming up next here on Sundial. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. From the words of the great T.S. Eliot, genuine poetry can communicate before it's understood. The quote can resonate for lovers of poetry and for those rediscovering their passion. It also speaks to the criticisms often presented of poetry, that its meaning is sometimes lost in the language. Palm Beach State College English professor Brad Johnson wants to change the way you think about poetry. He recently won the prestigious Wheelbarrow Books Poetry Prize from Michigan State University, and he will have a book of poetry published through Wheelbarrow Books February of next year. And Johnson writes witness poetry. He's going to explain what that is. He's joining us from the studios of WXEL in Boynton Beach. Mr. Johnson, welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Witness poetry. Tell us what that is. Help us understand. What is this?
Well, so witness poetry, the judge of this contest was Carolyn Forche, and she's put collections of poetry called Against Forgetting, where she collects witness poetry from people that have experienced trauma, genocide, and my poetry isn't that type of witness. My witnessing is more of the everyday. And hopefully what I try to do is sort of present everyday experiences that are relatable to the reader, and then I can sort of demonstrate how those images have more larger meanings.
How did you end up writing? How did you get into writing witness poetry and not something else?
Well, I mean, I my biography, being a straight white male, is limited. So I just try to connect through the shared experiences that we all have. And I think that what you mentioned regarding communication in poetry is many people feel that they pick up a poem and it's obfuscating and hard to understand. And so they often say, well, I don't understand poetry. And often it's the poet's fault. You know, if you read poetry and you don't understand it, some poets like that. That makes them feel smart and intelligent, the fact that they're misunderstood. I think that is not the point of art. I think it's rather to communicate a shared experience, which makes us human and American. I'm really interested in what makes us American these days of Russia.
All right. Can you give us a little example? I think that might help us understand a little bit more about witness poetry. I think you have one of your poems, Smuggling. I love this. Smuggling Elephants Through Airport Security.
Yes, and this is the title poem of my upcoming collection. Smuggling Elephants Through Airport Security. Audrey and her husband pick us up at LaGuardia and ask how our flight was. I tell them about going through security in Fort Lauderdale, how the belt buckle my mom gave me for my birthday, shaped like a revolver cylinder, looked suspicious, like a weapon, to the TSA agent, and how I spent the time it took my wife to be x-rayed and reshoot, explaining how the buckle was meant to look like a revolver but was not, in fact, a gun. To illustrate my point, I showed the agent the yellow elephant my son crayoned on green construction paper during the drive to the airport. Elephants, I said, are not allowed through security. Then I pointed to the picture my son drew, insisting, but this is a representation of a thing. It is not the thing. This is not an elephant. The agent said he understood my buckle wasn't real, but warned how replicas might be mistaken for authentic by agents at different terminals. I tell Audrey how odd it felt debating Plato, arguing about shadows projected on cave walls in an American airport, when her husband in the backseat says he knows exactly what I mean. When they last traveled through Hartford, TSA confiscated their son's Plato, claiming it resembled explosive clay.
All right.
And you should laugh. It's funny. Funny is a great communicator. That's what people...
Well, listen, I think I get what this is, but tell us what's the story behind this.
Well, I think we all complain about TSA. There's nothing more common, I suppose. but the idea of is the representation of a thing. And this is, I think, what we're always trying to figure out the meaning. We're always debating what something means. I tell my students, if anyone ever tells them that, if anyone says I love you to them, the first thing they should ask is, what do you mean? Right? Do you mean you want to spend the rest of your life with me, or do you mean you like how I combine mayonnaise and mustard when I make a turkey sandwich?
Profound and actually a good thing to think about. I'm talking with Brad Johnson, Palm Beach State College English professor. He recently won the Wheelbarrow Books Poetry Prize out of Michigan State University. He has a new book of poetry coming out in February of 2020. You know, you talk about your students, and I'm wondering, you know, do they relate better to this style of poetry? You know, because I just remember as a student, poetry, there were times I ran into poetry I loved, and then a lot of times I was like, oh, we got to do this.
Right. And I tell my students that you're going to read poetry you don't like, and that's okay. You're allowed to have your own taste. But the great thing about poetry is unless you're reading Homer or, you know, Byron's Don Juan, the commitment is small, right?
You
read a page, and if you don't like it, what have you lost? You know, it's an elevator ride. Whereas if you read a novel, by the time you get halfway through, you realize you're not into it anymore. Like, weeks have passed. So poetry, I think, is really built for today's sort of shortest attention span theater. Like, you can pull up a poem on your phone instead of reading like an 8-year-old Home and Gardens magazine in the dental office. And that'll be better for you.
You know, that's interesting. I wondered, is it in today's world, because we're used to texting, keeping our messages short, Twitter being limited to just a certain number of characters and emojis. I wonder if that's just leading us into a world where we're just going to speak poetically.
That would be an ideal, to say that there's poetry in Twitter. I think there can be, but obviously, like, you have to spell things right.
But I meant you know, the fact that we're used to reading and writing things in short sentences or in just short ideas, chopped up ideas. Does that lead to maybe appreciating poetry more?
Well, that's what poetry is and can be. And I mean, and it's odd that people think of poetry as like an anachronism. Yes, if you read Shakespeare's sonnets, there's these and thous in them. And sometimes when people, my students, write poetry, they use thee and thou. And that's not the point. The point, I think, is to use contemporary language, use contemporary images, and make it yours now. Everything's been said, but, you know, and that was Aristotle 2,000 years ago. And so all you can do, I think, is to say, this is my experience. These are the details of my life. Often I get blamed for some of the details that I put in my poetry, but they're not my fault. It's just these are the tools of everyday experience. It's not my fault that it takes 8 hours to buy Sudafed at CVS.
Real briefly, what do you tell your students about how you make a living as a poet?
Make a living doing something else. You don't do it for, the fact that I'm on the radio now, this is about as much fame as any poet can expect.
And so you tell a student, if they have a passion for poetry, I mean, you can, but, you know, you're going to have to be an adult and have a job, right?
Well, I have a job, but it also allows me to, you know, some people that write like to talk about writing, which I do. Some people don't. Some people like doing construction and writing poetry. I think everyone should be creating art. And my form is poetry, because poetry can be anything. And if you're not creating art, you should be making, you know, art out of your life. And if your art isn't your life, then you should go back to making art, no matter what it is. Like, capture your experience of your existence and articulate it.
And you do it with Witness Poetry. It is some fascinating stuff, and we'll share some online. You have to check it out. Again, I love this one, Smuggling Elephants Through Airport Security. It's a great one. Brad Johnson, Palm Beach State College English professor, winner of the Wheelbarrow Books Poetry Prize out of Michigan State University. Again, his new book of poetry coming out in February of 2020. Mr. Johnson, thanks again, and congratulations.
Hey, thanks so much, man. I appreciate it.
All right, still to come, get your dancing shoes out. If not, at least enjoy a little mambo. It's coming up next on Sundial. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. You've been listening to music featured in the new documentary film, The Mamboniques. Back in the 50s and 60s, when mambo was hugely popular, some of its biggest fans were Jewish. They took on the nickname Mamboniques. Many of the New York Jews fell in love with the music and took their passion here to South Florida. The Mamboniques premiered at the Miami Film Festival and will have a second showing at the Silver Spot Cinema in downtown Miami tomorrow at 7 p.m. I talked to the director and documentary filmmaker Lex Gillespie and Jewish dance lover, or Mambonique, Judy Friend, who goes by Mambo Judy.
In Yiddish, if you add the suffix nick, N-I-K, to a word, like baseball nick or wine nick, it means someone who's an aficionado of it or someone who's in love with it. A mambo nick is somebody who's just crazy for mambo.
I was curious as to when mambo really started to go in the U.S. How did it get here, and when was it really hot?
I would say it started in the late 1940s. And around 1950, it kind of percolated up from Cuba. And there was a musician, Perez Prado, who came, and he had a hit song called Mambo Number 5. As well, in New York, you had people like Tito Puente coming in, and Tito Rodriguez and Machito from Cuba. There was an infusion of Puerto Ricans coming to New York, and they brought the music with them. There was a large population of Jewish people in New York, and these two cultures just came together.
How did you hear about the Jewish community getting into mambo music?
Well, first of all, I should tell you, I'm not Jewish, but my wife is Jewish. And she told me a story about her grandmother had this kind of a bucket list thing to do. And she wanted to go to the Catskill Mountains, which was the summer resorts for the Jewish people. She didn't get the chance to do that, but she was in her 80s. And she said, I want to go to Grossinger's Resort and I want to learn how to cha-cha-cha. And when my wife told me that, I thought, what? So this kind of started me on the path.
You know, and we just heard Judy laughing, but before we bring her in, how did you meet her?
You know, when I started working on the film, I came to Florida, and everybody said, you got to go to this place called the Gold Coast Ballroom. It's in Coconut Creek. So Sunday afternoon, I went to the Gold Coast, and that's where all the Mamboniques were. And I met Mambo Judy there. I met everybody, pretty much everybody in my film, with a few people. I did some interviews in New York. But basically, the story was down here in South Florida.
Mambo Judy. What does mambo mean to you?
Oh, it's the essence of my life, because absolutely the mambo is the most exciting dance there is to me. And it's a mix of so many different rhythms from so many different places.
Do you remember the first time you heard it?
Yes, I was about 11 or 12, and my sister was doing it with her friends, and they were laughing at me trying to imitate them. So, yes, I did, but I was infected by the mambo disease from then on.
Is it true that Tito Puente, one of the mambo kings, played at your wedding?
Yes, he did. By that time, I had become more professional, and I was working in a called the Corso in Manhattan. And he was one of the many bands that came there, and I always liked him the best, so I was always running to dance to him. And my partner said to me, he was hiring the bands. He said, I could get him for a much... I said, I don't want Tito Puente. He's a fortune. He said, no, no, I'll get him for a good price. Tito would not come with fewer than 15 pieces. I needed a four-piece band, but he came with his 15 pieces, and... my older relatives were putting their fingers in their ears. It was too much for them. They were old people. They had culture shock beyond belief. And then my partner announced, none of you know maybe what Judy's been doing the last few years, so we're going to show you. And we did our show with me in my wedding gown. That was it.
I'm talking with director and documentary filmmaker Lex Gillespie. His new film, The Mambo Nicks, chronicles the rise of mambo music in the U.S., but how it specifically appealed to one segment of the population, the Jewish community. It follows the so-called Mambo Nicks, a nickname given to Jewish community in the 1950s and 60s in New York that loved to dance the mambo. Now, many of those Jews have migrated to South Florida, and we've been hearing from Mambo Judy. Judy, let me start with you. What is it about mambo that appealed to the Jewish people?
I think it was the movement of the body and the sound. It's incorporated with Jewish music and Jewish rhythms. I mean, it really comes, it's a combination of Latin jazz, Caribbean music, and the Latinos. So it was so many infused things that it just reflected in our history.
And Lex, you know, the documentary shows how Miami Beach really, I mean, it's like this is the place to be, and you reference like the Fountain Blue Hotel. Tell us about that rise again of mambo here in Miami Beach.
Well, I think Miami Beach played a real critical role in it because the sounds were coming over from Cuba and people were visiting. Many Jewish people were vacationing in Miami Beach. I had seen this photograph of these two guys, and one guy was holding the key to Miami Beach and the other guy was holding a song sheet in his hand, and its title was Miami Beach Rumba. And I had to, and it was a mystery. I didn't know anything about this. But what happened in 1946, Miami Beach, in fact, was so in love with these with this Latin sounds that it had a song that became its anthem, Miami Beach Rumba, written by Irving Fields, the pianist. He was holding the keys to the city of Miami Beach because it had such an impact. Apparently, this was the anthem for people who came down here. It really became a kind of a theme song, a rallying cry, or... every band, apparently, if you are working Miami Beach hotels or clubs, you better know Miami Beach Rumba, because at some point in the night, people are going to ask for it and they're going to dance to it.
I started out to go to Cuba. Soon I was at Miami Beach.
Something else really interesting, too, that you point out is how at these venues, everybody was welcome. It didn't matter who you were.
On the surface, my film is about the mambo, and it's about the story of this dance that everyone fell in love with and still loves that are dancing it today. But in other ways, it's really a look at how two very different cultures came together. And they came together at a time when America was pretty divided by race. There was racial segregation was very prevalent. But somehow, on the dance floors of New York and Miami Beach, these two groups came together. And for me, that was just a really beautiful thing.
Judy, you still dancing the mambo?
I am still dancing the mambo. I did at least a few hours Saturday night, and we got the entire place that we were in, which was a Latin restaurant. Everybody got up dancing with us, and they were applauding us at the end.
And you were telling me you just saw the movie for
yes,
the first time.
Yes, yesterday for the first time.
What was that like?
I was in shock. It was so good. First of all, I didn't stop laughing because when you laugh when things are true, and he brought them out.
Did you go with your fellow Mambo Nicks to the show to see it?
Yes. Yes, we had a whole crowd. And then after that, where did we go? To a Latin restaurant to dance some more.
That is Judy Friend, better known as Mambo Judy. You also heard from filmmaker Lex Gillespie. The movie is The Mambo Nicks, and it is screening at the Silver Spot Cinema in downtown Miami tomorrow at 7 o'clock. You can find out more at WLRN.org. I'm Luis Hernandez. Have a great day. We'll talk to you tomorrow.
Yo soy un hombre sincero, dijo Martí, de donde crece la palma. Y antes de morir.